We had a fascinating conversation about grace this past Wednesday at the Oshkosh Wellspring Wednesday. So I'd figured that this month's worship and learning theme of grace might be challenging to some fellowship folks, especially some of you who were raised in traditional Christian churches. It's one of the many theological terms that some folks here have to wrestle with to decide whether to reclaim or maybe just let them go. This is where my own personal liberal religious background does not serve me so well. I grew up in a church that used grace in a thoroughly liberal religious way, and so I know that's a minority experience here. Well, anyway, in the Oshkosh group, I gained a deeper sense of the struggle that some of you may be having this month as we continue to explore grace. One person in particular shared her experience with grace in her 1960s Catholic upbringing. Grace worked like this in her church. You could earn a state of grace by confessing your sins to the priest and then doing whatever penance the priest prescribed. You needed to be in a state of grace in order to receive communion. So problems arose, for example, if you confessed and then did the penance, but meanwhile committed an additional sin before the next service. What do you do? Go up to get communion even though you know you're not in a state of grace? Or sit there while your parents wonder what the hell you did? And speaking of hell, this drama about being in a state of grace was more than a week-to-week matter. You needed to die in a state of grace to have your ticket to heaven punched. So if you were not in a state of grace at the moment of death, which, let's face it, sometimes happens unexpectedly, then you were headed to purgatory, or possibly even the eternal flames of hell. So the stakes felt rather high. Now, to be fair, I don't think this is standard Catholic theology today, and it's possible that it was a misinterpretation even back in the 1960s. One person at yesterday's service shared about her upbringing in a Catholic church, and she had a beautiful story of sharing, confessing a sin to her priest, and the priest prescribing the perfect kind of repentance, and that it ended up healing a relationship. So I acknowledge all that. Nonetheless, I take the person from Oshkosh's experience seriously, and I suspect that many of you in the fellowship, which by my estimate is probably two-thirds former Catholic, that many of you can relate to that understanding of grace and are having difficulty this month. So all this said, I have to say that the misunderstanding of grace that radiates through this Oshkosh person's experience of grace and her Catholic upbringing, to me, it's just breathtaking. Instead of being an unearned gift, grace was something you had to earn. And there was only one way to earn it, by confessing and then doing penance. Do these things and voila, you have grace. Do them consistently so that you're in a state of grace when you die, and voila, you have heaven. In my view, this is pretty much the opposite of how grace really works. Grace, an unearned gift from something beyond yourself, in this situation morphed into something that you earn. So I can well imagine that if you had this sort of experience of grace in your upbringing, you may have long ago consigned grace to the dustbin, and maybe it's best for you to leave it there. But if so, I hope that you'll figure out another word, another way to describe unearned gifts from beyond yourself, because I think those gifts come our way all the time, great and small. These gifts, for me, I think are wellsprings of joy, of meaning, of gratitude. So if serendipity or synchronicity or luck or some other word better describes this for you and lacks the baggage of grace, well, just go ahead and use that word. Earlier this month, I lifted up that grace is a gift that is not only unearned, but often undeserved. Today I want to soften this a bit and say, okay, yeah, sometimes maybe we deserve the grace, but we don't necessarily deserve it. And for me, it's really important to emphasize that grace has nothing to do really with whether we earned it or whether we deserve it. This is my answer to what I consider to be a warped and destructive understanding of grace that the Oshkosh former Catholic, now Unitarian Universalist, shared. And this is really important when it comes to alcoholics and other addicted people. Doing things you regret, sometimes profoundly, seems to go hand in hand with addiction. Shame and guilt are two of the engines that keep addiction humming along. Recovery is a gift from beyond that every single addict can experience, no matter how bad the things she or he may have done. The gift of recovery has nothing whatsoever to do with deserving it or not. Now, I'm not saying that there's nothing that an addicted person can do to help recovery happen. Of course there is. An addicted person shouldn't just keep on drinking and drugging and just hope that grace, like some magic wand, will make things happen and suddenly recovery happens. Doing the hard work of recovery, going to meetings, delving deeply into your spiritual soul, into your experiences, repairing relationships, these are the things that are so important in recovery. But in my experience, there is always, always an element of grace in recovery. There's a gift from beyond the addicted person that is not necessarily earned or deserved. And no one is beyond the possibility of receiving the gift of recovery. As long as an addicted person is alive, there is hope. The poster child for this, in my experience, is Harriet T., a woman who experienced the grace of recovery in the early 1990s. She went through something like 7 different treatment programs and nothing ever worked. She felt utterly hopeless. She felt like she didn't deserve recovery. And then suddenly, and this is grace to me, she tried one more treatment program, and for whatever reason, it worked. Part of Harriet's recovery journey was replacing alcohol as the center of her life with something more spiritually positive. And it is this interior spiritual journey that brought her to our fellowship. Many of you who were part of the fellowship in the early and mid-1990s will remember Harriet and her story. And you'll also remember that not too many years into recovery, she was felled by lung cancer. Lung cancer is usually not a very good way to die. Physically, she was miserable. But right up to her last labored breath, she felt like, as she often observed, that she was the luckiest person in the world. She never expected to have a single day, let alone a couple years of recovery. Her last few years of recovery were, in some profound sense, an undeserved gift she never thought she'd get. The last horrible chapter of cancer did not in the slightest dampen her gratitude for this gift. I have a good friend whose mother was a fairly high-functioning alcoholic. Oh, she struggled. Her family struggled with her, but this was not so evident to others. When this alcoholic woman's husband was diagnosed with terminal cancer a few years ago, her addiction quickly brought her and her family to new lows. In the midst of this hell on earth experience, as her husband moved toward death and then died, suddenly, out of nowhere, a door of recovery swung open, and somehow this woman walked through it. And even as she continues to walk through the valley of grief and guilt and shame, she has recovered her soul in beautiful and amazing ways. Yeah, she's working hard. Her family worked hard, and they were skillful in applying some tough love. But there is a huge element of grace in this woman's story, too. Her recovery, like Harriet T's, is nothing less than a miracle. None of this is about deserving recovery. And this miracle of recovery, as long as an addicted person is alive, is a possibility, and this is a hope that I fervently hold on to as my niece continues to struggle with heroin addiction. Addiction is, at its core, a spiritual disease, a disease of the soul. To use another religious term that may or may not work for you, addiction is idolatry. It's putting something at the center of your life that is destructive, that is not worthy of being at the center. Motivated, I think, in some ways by a desire to be happy, to be whole, sometimes we just chase the wrong thing. We become attached to the wrong behavior, the wrong things, the wrong person. The behavior thing, person we are addicted to becomes a false god, and we become ensnared in its grasp. So then, instead of having something like love or compassion or connection or beauty or God or goddess or living ethically at the center of our lives, instead, we put something destructive. In this view, addiction encompasses far more than attachment to alcohol or other drugs. The late great psychiatrist theologian Gerald May wrote a wonderful book called Addiction and Grace. And in that, he had a laundry list of things we could get addicted to, literally hundreds of things, from anger, approval, attractiveness, being right, cleanliness, eating and exercise, to sex, the stock market, stress, sunbathing, and work. So the implication of all this to me is that, in one way or another, we are all addicts. We all at times attach our spiritual desire to the wrong behavior, the wrong thing, the wrong person. We all are searching imperfectly for wholeness and happiness. We all, from time to time, worship false gods. Addiction to alcohol and other drugs just tends to be a little more obvious than a lot of the other addictions. This sermon, then, is not just for alcoholics, not just for addicts and the people that love them. It's for all of us because, in short, we are all addicts. Among other things, addiction to something, whatever kind of addiction, impairs our receptivity to grace. And at the very same time, as Gerald May notes, grace can shine radiantly through addiction. Addiction makes it hard to see and experience grace, but when an addicted person does see grace and walks through that door to recovery, it's one of the most powerful and radiant spiritual experiences there is. This is what Harriet T. meant, that even when she was dying of cancer, when she said she was the luckiest person in the world. And so you see, recovery is not just about abstaining from drinking or drugging or whatever thing we're addicted to. What recovery is putting something new and more constructive, more positive, at the center of our lives. It's about walking a path toward healing and wholeness rather than being mired in destruction and disease. And some of the most amazing spiritual journeys I've witnessed, like Harriet T's, like a lot of you, are undertaken by people recovering from addiction. In his book, Gerald May uses biblical metaphors of desert and garden to describe the journey from addiction to recovery. As a person moves into recovery and does that soul work of this new spiritual path, the desert greens into a garden through the living water of grace, as May puts it. He goes on to write, "The deserts of our lives may be large or small, chosen or forced, brief or prolonged. Yet all of them have similar terrain. They all involve struggle with addiction, and they all will have spiritual significance. Each will be an opportunity for freedom or slavery, and each has the potential to become a garden." He goes on to talk about 5 signposts that can point the way for us in this journey from the desert of addiction to the garden of recovery. These signposts are honesty, dignity, community, responsibility, and simplicity. So honesty is first, because the living water of grace will not have a chance to turn into a beautiful, green, lush garden if we're not honest with ourselves. Denial and dishonesty are so powerful in fueling addiction. And this is why the 12 steps repeatedly call the recovering addict to fearless self-reflection, self-honesty, self-inventory. The signpost of dignity lifts up the essential affirmation that every person, including addicted people, in spite of all the mistakes, all the bad things we've done, every person has inherent dignity and worth. Essential goodness lies within all. Community lifts up the vital importance of companions along the way. Our companions cannot save us, but their love, their care, whether embodied in a tender way or a tough way, well, that can help point the way. Responsibility is a signpost that captures that while the heart of the recovery journey is interior, the actions we take also matter a great deal. Recovery is only real if we generally, which is not to say perfectly, make decisions that help us progress in our journey of recovery. And then simplicity is the perfect final signpost. There's a real simple core truth about recovery, which is that we need to stop doing whatever that destructive behavior was. That's the simple core of it. Now, of course, the garden that is recovery is not perfect. Every garden experiences, of course, cycles of growth and decay. Harriet T's beautiful garden of recovery included cancer. The cancer did not destroy the garden's beauty, but it was certainly a real and painful part of it. Recovery is not a destination, but a continued journey through life's inevitable ups and downs. And to me, no words sum up better this journey from desert to garden than those words from Mary Oliver we did as the responsive reading. So I will close by reading that beautiful poem once more. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert, repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things.